I have such a great pleasure to introduce you to Brenda Nelson Strauss, who will be talking about the Black Jubilee Quartets at the Hampton Institute, the Natalie Curtis Berlin Cylinders from 1915. But before, Brenda has a little announcement of her own to make. So here you have, come here.
Well, we'll begin with a commercial announcement then, if I can find it. I'd just like to let all of you know, even though I think it's going to be printed in the newsletter later, that the Archives of Traditional Music at Indiana University will be hosting a symposium next year on March 22nd through the 24th. And the title of the symposium is going to be A Century of Field Recordings. Let me read the little blurb here, which will provide a forum for a critical reassessment of the impact of ethnographic sound recording technology from the first cylinder recordings to the present. And this goes on. I won't read all of it, but we are initiating a call for papers. And so if any of you are interested in being a participant, I would certainly urge you to speak with me at some point, and I can give you the information from this. Also, we are writing a small grant for the symposium. We don't yet know if that will go through, but if it does, then the speakers would receive some travel money. Okay, so much for the commercial announcement. I do have some handouts. I'm sorry, there are only about 29 or 30 of these, so some of you, if you could share, that would be appreciated. I'm afraid I had a major fight with Kinko's yesterday because they saw the copyright on the bottom of the first page and said they wouldn't reproduce it for me, even though some of the pages had come off my own computer. So if some of you can share, that would be fine. Okay, I'll go ahead and start since I don't really get to the musical examples for a while. That will give you all a chance to get those pages. After Jesse Walter Fuchs made the first field recording in March of 1980, when he used an Edison cylinder machine to record Passamaquoddy Indian songs and tales, other anthropologists, ethnomusicologists, and linguists quickly followed suit. And for the next 30 years, field recordings made in the United States focused primarily on the collection of rapidly vanishing Native American music and oral traditions. One of those early collectors of Native American music was Natalie Curtis. As a young woman, Curtis sought a career as a concert pianist and composer. She studied in New York under Arthur Friedheim, then spent several years in Europe studying under Busoni, Wolff, and Niece, and cultivating a circle of friends that included the Wagners and the Mahlers. When Curtis returned to the United States in 1900, however, she had the opportunity to hear Hopi songs while visiting her brother in the Southwest. The experience was apparently so powerful that, at the age of 25, she decided to switch careers in order to devote herself to the full-time study of Indian music. Over the next 10 years, she made numerous cylinder recordings of Indian music and became an activist for Native American rights and published the Indians book, from which I might add Busoni used quite a few of the melodies for use in his works, but that, of course, is the topic of another paper. Published in 1907, the Indians book consisted of the songs and short stories of 18 different tribes. As an activist, Curtis published this collection as an appeal to the American public. By instilling in them an appreciation of Indian art and music, she hoped to simultaneously provoke a greater understanding of and tolerance for Indian culture and also eliminate some of the most destructive governmental policies. She succeeded at least to a certain extent, for the book was enormously popular and has, in fact, enjoyed frequent reprints, including a new edition published as recently as 1987. Scholars praise the book's musical transcriptions, considered to be the most accurate of that era, for Curtis's musical training, adeptness with a cylinder machine, and persistence enabled her to succeed at transcribing complex Indian melodies and rhythms where most others had failed. While compiling the Indians book, Curtis made frequent visits to the Hampton Institute in Virginia in order to utilize its Indian students as informants and graphic artists for the book. The Institute, founded in 1868 to provide industrial training for Native Americans, had by that time expanded its mission to include Afro-Americans and foreign students from backwards cultures, that is, you know, what we would now call third world countries. Though there was an attempt to prepare students for assimilation into the predominantly white society, Hampton also tried to preserve and encourage Native arts and musical traditions. Curtis, impressed by the Institute's mission, became an ardent supporter. In 1913, Hampton's directors approached Curtis with a proposition: would she undertake the study of Afro-American music and do for it what she had previously tried to do for that of the Indian, that is, to present the music with entire genuineness and in a form of publication that could be readily grasped by all people. Aware of the scholarly neglect of Afro-American music, Curtis responded to their plea and agreed to conduct research among Hampton's black students. Over the next few years, she prepared herself by traveling throughout the South, listening to spirituals, folk songs, work songs, and camp meeting hymns in an effort to gain a familiarity with Afro-American musical traditions, for she believed, quote, "It is of the highest importance that the transcriber of folk music should live in the midst of the folk singers, where he can drink in the atmosphere and spirit of the instinctive song of an unself-conscious people. Thus, the folk song, no longer a musical specimen like a butterfly on a pin, becomes a part of the recorder's own being, so that he thinks and feels musically in the same rhythms and accents with the singer, until at last grows up within him an almost intuitive concept of an adequate written form." At this same time, Curtis shifted her political activism away from Indian causes in order to promote black music. Joining forces with David Manns, she assisted in the formation of the music school settlement in Harlem and also assisted with the arrangement of several concerts of black music, including the legendary Clef Club performance at Carnegie Hall. Her work had a major impact on the acceptance and subsequent promotion of black music in the pre-jazz era. As promised, however, Curtis returned to the Hampton Institute between approximately 1913 and 1918 to study not only Afro-American music, but the music of African students as well. Her research culminated in two works, Songs and Tales from the Dark Continent, which examined the indigenous music of two African students, and a four-volume set titled Hampton Series Negro Folk Songs. She selected for inclusion in the latter publication four-part gospel quartets, work songs, and children's songs, which she considered to be, quote, typically Negro, discarding those that seemed more obviously white man influenced. Since Afro-American folk songs and spirituals had previously only been published in arranged collections intended primarily for white audiences and amateur musicians, Curtis hoped to provide transcriptions which would approximate as closely as possible the actual performance practice of the singers. Of this she wrote, "Most white people have caught the melody by ear and then added harmonies of their own, yet often even the melody has not closely followed the characteristic details of Negro rhythm, nor the free extemporaneous qualities of Negro singing. The song has consciously been reduced to what the recording musician thinks should be its correct form, so that the transcription does not really represent a song as the Negroes sing it, but a musical translation." Curtis also wished to produce a record of a tradition which was largely ignored and in danger of vanishing, yet in committing these melodies to paper, she did not wish to prescribe, and said of this, "All I have tried to do is to record with entire accuracy, to put on paper at least one faithful reproduction of the fluent loveliness of Negro singing. I therefore set myself the same uncompromising ideal that I have striven to follow in all my previous notations of unrecorded folk music. I endeavored to put in written form, without addition or change of any kind, the true folk song, spirit, and sound, just as it springs from the hearts and the lips of the folk singers. In other words, I tried to reflect on paper completely, but only what the people sang. As most of the Negro songs are in essence group songs, and as Negro group singing, which is spontaneous and almost inevitable where two or three colored people are gathered together, is usually part singing, I determined to record every part as sung, and also to seize as nearly as notation would permit each nuance, rhythmic and dynamic. That she succeeded in her attempts to accurately transcribe the songs is evident in the praise given her by other scholars. Howard Odum and Guy B. Johnson, in writing of their attempts to record the four-part harmonies of Black work songs, stated that they found it impossible for any one singer to perform alone without the other three supporting parts, and also impossible for Odum and Johnson to transcribe one part separately while all four were singing. They finally settled for notating just the lead voice and later supplied the harmonies themselves. So in their opinion, Curtis was the only one who had thus far succeeded in that task. And this is where the cylinder comes into play. To achieve such a high degree of accuracy, she used her Edison cylinder machine and simply moved the horn in front of the particular singer she wished to feature. In this manner, she could record four cylinders for each song and then transcribe them at her leisure. Though she realized that the songs were not always repeated in the same manner, she felt that at least she would be able to present a version which had been harmonized by the singers themselves. She also found it invaluable to record two separate versions of each song, one by a young amateur quartet and another by Hampton's Big Quartet, the latter composed of four older men who had been singing together professionally for many years. From these two versions, she was able to draw conclusions as to which renditions were of a more improvisatory nature and which seemed to be more standardized, and by that I think she means more of what she called white man influenced. Though that methodology may seem very obvious to us today, at the time it represented quite a breakthrough in facilitating the transcription of multi-part singing, learned not from written music, but from oral tradition. Although many recent publications have declared Curtis's cylinders lost, at the Archives of Traditional Music at Indiana University, 16 of her Afro-American cylinders are extant and contain various versions of six spirituals sung, I believe anyway, by the amateur quartet. Five of those spirituals I have analyzed, for the sixth is incomplete and of very poor sound quality. But the cylinders, accompanied as they are by Curtis's musical transcriptions, allow new insights into a unique chapter in the study of Black music. By comparing these transcriptions with extant cylinders, the accuracy of her transcriptions may be tested and her methodology analyzed. Now, I hope I haven't bored you too much by such a detailed setup to the recordings, but I really wanted to lay that background and to create an understanding of what I'm doing with these. So now, if you look at pages 1 through 3 of the handout, they contain the transcriptions for the spiritual "Tis Me, O Lord," which was printed in volume 2 of Negro Folk Songs. And if you look carefully at the annotations on the front page, you'll notice that Curtis did make every effort to accurately notate elements of the vocal style, as well as indicating various melodic, harmonic, and rhythmic variants. Now I'll play Curtis's first cylinder of "Tis Me, O Lord," and if you listen closely, you'll see that it emphasizes the tenor line. Then this will be followed immediately by the second cylinder. Unfortunately, it is of poor sound quality, but again, if you listen, you'll see that that cylinder emphasizes the baritone line. And I believe as I play these, if you follow along with the music, you'll be able to gain a clearer understanding of how she utilized the cylinder machines to facilitate these transcriptions.
Little skip there.
this will be the baritone line. Okay, not all of the cylinders are as of poor quality as that last one, but I really did want to illustrate how she brought out the different parts. And you might have noticed as you followed along, at least in my opinion, one of the main differences between Curtis's transcriptions and these particular recorded versions is perhaps in the notation of the rhythms, for I clearly heard more dotted rhythms than Curtis employed. But she does discuss her methodology in the book, and she attended the rehearsals of this quartet for at least a month and did state that she was trying to just capture an average version, so we don't know that she really missed that. She could have just been averaging out the performances. You also might notice in the transcription of the text that Curtis followed the practice of notating black English that was prevalent in that day, and if you look at the texts, and really seem to exaggerate the pronunciation, or so it seems, to the extent that that's still audible on these particular cylinders. Now, in comparison to Curtis's transcriptions, the "Tis Me" that's printed on page 4 was taken from Thomas Fenner's Religious Folk Songs of the Negro that was first published by the Hampton Institute in 1874, and then this comes from the revised and enlarged version from 1909, which was just prior to Curtis's time there. And prior to Curtis's Negro folk songs in 1918, the Fenner score was used at Hampton for several decades to teach the spirituals to incoming students. So obviously the two versions are quite different. In Fenner's version, the rhythms are not syncopated. The four voices are scored much closer together. The solo line is more stagnant with an entirely different melodic line. There's no responsorial, and as a result, one measure is omitted. It is, however, still written in a major key with similar harmonies, texts, and overall form. Yet if sung as written, the result would be a quartet of a totally different style. At present, it may be impossible to tell if the spiritual was ever sung exactly as written in this version. I have, however, a Victor recording of "Tis Me, O Lord" as sung by the Hampton Quartet in 1941, just before it was disbanded. And you'll see that it's really quite similar to Curtis's version.
Tis me, O Lord, standing in the need of prayer. Tis me, O Lord, standing in the need of prayer. Tis me, O Lord, standing in the need of prayer. Tis me, O Lord, standing in the need of prayer.
It's not my mother, but it's me, O Lord,
standing in the need of prayer. It's not my mother, but it's me, O Lord, standing in the need of prayer.
It's not my father, but it's me, O Lord,
standing in the need of prayer. It's not my father, but it's me, O Lord, standing in the need of prayer.
Tis me,
tis me, O Lord, standing in the need of prayer.
Lord,
tis me, O Lord, standing in the need of prayer.
Tis me,
tis me, O Lord, standing in the need of prayer.
Lord,
standing in the need of prayer.
It's not my brother, but it's me, O Lord.
Okay, and I played that version to point out that possibly we can conclude that this was the standard version of the spiritual at Hampton for several decades then, and that Curtis was the first to capture the music both on paper and cylinder. The same holds true for the spiritual "Go Down, Moses." On page 5 and 6 of the handout is the music from Curtis's Negro folk songs. Now, I did have to reproduce this on my computer because the original photocopy came from microfilm, so I've tried to do that as closely to Curtis's version as possible. But watch especially for the rubato at the beginning of the song as I play Curtis's recording.
Oh,
Okay, now once again, I'm going to follow this version with a Victor recording of the Hampton Quartet singing again in 1941. And you might want to compare it instead to the music from Fenner's religious folk songs, Go Down Moses, which appears, I believe, on page 4.
Go down, Moses, way down in Egypt's land. Tell old Pharaoh,
Okay, again, the two recorded versions are quite similar, even after 25 years, and vary greatly from Fenner's score, since his version doesn't begin with the chorus, uses a simpler melodic line, and lacks syncopation. So I'm using these 1941 examples, then, to illustrate the consistency in the style of these spirituals as sung at Hampton on the extant recordings anyway, and as further evidence that printed scores of that era are in all probability, as Curtis had pointed out, extremely unreliable. So overall, the spirituals on these cylinders seem to be representative of the early shift towards gospel known as the Jubilee period that lasted from approximately the late 1800s to 1929. This Jubilee style, characterized by a cappella singing in close harmonies, was first made popular by the Fisk Jubilee singers and was imitated extensively by Jubilee quartets at various black universities. Curtis's cylinders may represent one of the few early recordings of a folk-style gospel quartet, for many of the early Jubilee groups adhered more strictly to the Europeanized university style, employing standard English with clear diction, precise pronunciation, and a vocal timbre resembling trained singers, which I might point out was really quite clear on that last version of Go Down Moses from 1941. According to Kip Lornell, who has done a lot of work in this area, the early quartets that recorded commercially between 1895 and 1913, including the Fisk Jubilee Quartet, Standard Quartet, Dinwiddie Colored Quartet, and Polk Miller's Old South Quartet, all followed the university style. According to Lornell, though, folk groups, on the other hand, employed coarser vocal timbres, black dialect, jazz syncopation, portamento, and melodic and rhythmic ornamentation, which are all apparent in varying degrees on Curtis's Hampton cylinders. Though there are many commercial recordings of black quartets, and some predate the race record era, Curtis's cylinders recorded in 1915 at Hampton may represent the earliest extant field recordings of Afro-American music, predating those made by Guy B. Johnson and Lawrence Gellert by almost a decade. According to Johnson's, by the time scholars were awakened to the value of studying Afro-American music, race records were already widely available, and thus many scholars feared that the, quote, pure Afro-American folk songs had been corrupted by commercial recordings. Therefore, not until the late 20s and early 30s, when the Archive of Folk Music at the Library of Congress sponsored field trips to the South, were black songs more widely recorded by ethnomusicologists. So clearly, Curtis was ahead of her time, not only in regards to the accuracy of her transcriptions, but also in her careful attempt to examine the performance practice and also the performance context of the singers. Now I'm afraid I've run out of time, so I'll just conclude quickly here. My research on this subject is still in the preliminary stages and only represents a portion of my overall objective, which is to document Curtis's work and her contribution to ethnomusicology. I do hope to locate more commercial recordings of quartets, preferably those done before 1920, of the five spirituals contained on Curtis's cylinders, which are Go Down Moses, Tis Me, O Lord, Good News, Chariots Coming, Listen to the Lambs, and Every Time I Feel the Spirit. And this will allow me to examine more closely the evolution of the Jubilee style. And perhaps some of you who have had an opportunity to listen to those particular commercial records will have some comments on this subject. I did plan to visit Hampton Institute before giving this paper to collect additional information, but unfortunately that trip had to be postponed until just after this conference. So I do hope to gather more data and also work on Curtis's African cylinders, which were recorded at Hampton at the same time and allowed her to study the syncretism between African and Afro-American music and also of European music. Thank you.
Brenda, you still have about 3 minutes.
Okay.
There's some questions. Please come to the microphone. Do you have any more phones?
No, I'm sorry. I didn't bring more.
Dick Spotswood, Washington, D.C. Brenda, do you think the possible sequence may have tied those cylinders into some of those earlier Fisk University-oriented transcriptions, since, as you observed, the quartet is trying so much for that style, they may well indeed have been the professional quartet, at least from the oral evidence.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dick. One thing I had to cut from my paper was that point. In the book Negro Folk Songs, Curtis did print a version, I think it was of Go Down Moses. I really wanted to add that to the handout, but I didn't have, it was again a photocopy of a microfilm, and I didn't have time to try to get that into my computer, which some of you may know is extremely time consuming. So due to her transcription of the Big Quartet, which was a professional group, that was clearly much more Europeanized than the works on these cylinders, and so I'm concluding that she did not record the Big Quartet, but what she called the amateur group. But of course, that amateur group did rehearse regularly, and certainly
they were in the same mold very clearly too.
Prevalent style, only would have had a little more, perhaps had a little more freedom. But I'm sure they were heavily influenced by that.
And did she record the quartet in toto without the emphasis on one voice over the others? Do you have any?
No. Actually, all of these, for the most part, seem to emphasize one voice or the other, except the sixth song, which is God's Gonna Move Trouble, which unfortunately was not recorded, and I've not seen that that particular one printed anywhere. So that perhaps the rarest one is the poorest recording. But in that recording, only the chorus is recorded and doesn't seem to emphasize any one voice. And unfortunately, the folk songs and children's songs, which would have been much more interesting and truly unique on cylinder, do not seem to have been recorded by Curtis, or at least are not extant. But there seems to be some proof that she was a very competent musician, and by that time she'd done hundreds of transcriptions, and from statements that she made, I don't believe she used a cylinder machine unless she had to. So probably while she was at Hampton, she only used it for things she was having trouble with, including the quartets and some of the African songs.
Too bad she didn't see the recordings as an end in themselves.
Right.